Hi, my name is Gary Orenstein, and welcome to the second Cloud Computing Roundtable. I'm joined here by a whole group of folks. Really happy to have everyone. First of all, I'd like to introduce Jim Herbold, Vice President of Sales at Box.net. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks, Gary.
Also, we have two people from Zamanda today, Dmitry Jakovsky, Vice President of Product Management. Welcome, Dmitry.
Thank you, and you really mastered how to pronounce my last name.
I practiced very many times before we started, so. And also Ken Crandall, technologist at Zamanda, is with us. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
And we're really pleased on the phone to have with us Jeff Barr from Amazon. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Hello from sunny Seattle.
And Jeff is the Senior Manager of Web Services Evangelism, so as far as Cloud Computing Roundtable goes, I can't think of a better person to have join us. So what I thought we'd do is just spend some time talking about the recent news and events. There's so much stuff going on with cloud computing. It's really somewhat out of control. Every time I look through a major media publication, whether it's Business Week or Fortune or Forbes or the Wall Street Journal, there's always something popping up. And I'd, one of the most interesting articles that I saw recently was this War for the Web. And I know I shared it with you guys previously. But it's interesting in that Andy Kessler, who wrote this article on May 6th, talks about a relatively simple cloud computing model. I think one of the things about cloud computing has been a lot of complicated models that have come up. And he breaks it down into the cloud, the edge, speed, and platform as sort of components that are there and where Microsoft might have an advantage or Google might have an advantage or potentially Amazon has an advantage. And I was just curious, guys, if you want to open up the conversation as to if anybody had any thoughts in particular on some of the things he said, what are the key components that are important? Where are certain players ahead? So any thoughts on that? Go ahead, Ken.
Thank you. I think what's interesting is in distilling it down to those four points, he kind of identified where the touch points are of cloud computing. So cloud is kind of his euphemism for applications. Platform for developers and API, edge where devices interact and so forth. So I think rather than trying to define it as a set of technologies, he tried to more an envelope it and see how do we interact with it.
Yeah. Jeff, I'm sure you spend a lot of time trying to explain to people what cloud computing is.
I certainly do.
To read Andy's article in detail, but give us your perspective.
So I'm actually really, really impressed by how quickly people have really converged on this term. It's just in the last few months especially, it's just really been gratifying just as I go to various places and talk to different audiences, just how quickly that this term cloud computing has really come front and center to really, I think, represent the efforts that we're doing, that others are doing, to really just put these gigantic data centers and huge amounts of horsepower into the cloud and just make them available to developers and entrepreneurs and to say, push big applications up in the cloud and do some pretty amazing and impressive things.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of coverage, and again, I'm always fascinated when it starts to reach the mainstream periodicals, because then it's not just something for the technology geeks to enjoy. It's really, what is this impact on the end users?
I actually expect that very soon there will be a TV show about cloud computing. The same as they have about real estate market.
There we go.
CSI, maybe?
So, I think not we don't want to spend too much time on this article, but, the nice part, I think, of Andy's article is he said there's, people have advantages in different arenas. So just to go quickly through his conclusions, when he talks about the cloud, and in fact, a big part of what he says in the cloud is that Google is spending $842 million in the last 3 months on servers, data centers, and fiber optics. And for me, we often talk about the cloud as the delivery mechanism, but since I'm sort of an infrastructure guy and have that in my background, it's always good to know there's real dollars being spent. And so in this cloud category, saying, well, maybe Google has the advantage over Microsoft. And then in the edge category, we're talking about devices, mobile devices, PCs, video game boxes, he's saying that Microsoft has the advantage. He talks about speed, and I think that speed of delivery, we certainly know that in ranking the results of search results, Google's doing quite a lot there. And then on the platform side, he seems to be comparing the whole Microsoft infrastructure as a platform and the Windows ecosystem that goes with it, and saying that at this point in time, that Windows ecosystem on top of Microsoft is still larger than what Google has. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on that.
I've definitely got some thoughts on that. I think that this article It's nice in its simplicity, but it might be a little oversimplistic in narrowing mentions on the players who are involved in these things. I think Salesforce.com clearly has like the most viable ecosystem of revenue-generating application development on top of its platform. That's the going model out there, and that's the one that everyone's been watching and the one that really everybody's been trying to copy. I'm a Salesforce.com user. I've seen that develop over the last couple of years, and that's really the model that so many other companies are trying to pursue, from Facebook to, you know, the Microsofts and Googles, but companies like my own, like Box.net, where, you know, the open platform and data portability is really key. And it is changing the way that, businesses and consumers leverage data. But this whole article, generally speaking, I think one of the major points about cloud computing is it is going to enable that next wave of viable players in the marketplace, taking advantage of cloud pieces, but becoming the next big viable Google, Microsoft, whoever it might be.
Right.
I totally agree there.
Jeff, one question for you, and we'll talk a little bit more about Amazon Web Services specifically later in the podcast. The press seems to focus on Microsoft and Google right now. Perhaps that's because of the Yahoo acquisition activity. Yeah. But, you know, Amazon, which I still think of the front runner and the pioneer of this, sometimes doesn't get mentioned in the Clash of the Titans articles. And I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, we're really focusing on not like going out and trying to get extra amounts of press for doing things like building data centers and running fiber. We're really trying to make sure that we succeed at the developer level. And we go out and we talk to individual developers quite a bit and make sure developers understand what we're doing and that they're succeeding. And that developers, we want to make sure that developers and entrepreneurs really understand that with cloud computing, that they can really look at problems and potential problems in a whole new way. And instead of like worrying about what are their own resources that they can bring to bear on a problem, and do these individuals and sometimes small, sometimes large organizations, do they have a big enough data center? Do they have enough bandwidth that they can really start to let their imaginations go a bit wild and think, okay, now I don't have to worry about my own limited physical resources. What can I do if I can simply take essentially as much as I need from the cloud, use it when I need it, and then when I'm done, simply relinquish it and let someone else go ahead with it. And we've really focused a lot on making sure that the actual people using these things understand that's very, very much within their grasp.
Right. Ken, you were going to add something?
Yes, I think one of the things that really gets lost, even in this article and many articles, is a lot of the values in the cloud are when it's made transparent to the user. One of the things that Zamanda's done in utilizing the Amazon S3 service with our Zamanda Internet Backup is enabled users to back up data to the cloud without really worrying about the cloud itself. For them, it might as well be backing up to a disk or backing up to a tape or any other type of media. And really, the benefits of the cloud are all delivered without the user having to say, wow, I've got to do this cloud thing. And I think, really, maybe that's the hidden agenda when he awards the advantage to Microsoft in terms of the platform, is that if Microsoft wakes up and figures out a way to deliver cloud services underneath the apps people are already familiar with, they've already got a huge lead a lot in the desktop apps.
Right. When do I have save as where it's somewhat seamless? And there's cases with that. You can see that coming.
Live
no
mesh.
Doubt. No doubt.
Live mesh has implications.
Yeah.
Here.
So in another sense, once you get close enough to the cloud, you can't actually see it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And in my history of working on new technologies, I think we sometimes forget that sometimes the goal of the new technology is to become invisible.
That's right.
Let me make one final comment about this this article. First of all, I'm a big fan of India. It just happened that when I was thinking about making one particular investment, I read his book, Running the Money. And this book helped me to jump and to buy this particular company. And if I recall, I made something like 4 times of my investment. So it was Andy's advice was very, very good to me. And the point I'm trying to make is that he is a money man. So, and there's a reason why he writes this particular article for Wall Street Journal. So he looks not so much from technology perspective. He looks from what will happen to large players who are already trying to take advantage of this. I read somewhere they estimate it's $200 billion opportunity, cloud computing. Of course, there's a bunch of numbers already assigned. So, and this is his angle. And I personally think that there will be many, many new companies that will actually take full advantage, or it maybe will be familiar names, but they will have a really strong play in cloud computing space.
Absolutely. Let's jump into some of the quickly overview some of the new announcements that were made over the last couple of weeks. One, of course, is Sun's announcement with Amazon with the Open Solaris on EC2. Jeff, maybe you can just give us a 1 minute update on that.
Certainly. So one of the core features of Amazon EC2 is the fact that when you make a request into the cloud for some processing resources, which we call instances, you have to give us a pointer to a data structure called an AMI, an Amazon Machine Instance. So prior to the announcement, all of the AMIs were for various Linux operating system distributions. And with the announcement, we now have an AMI specific to Open Solaris. And so there's actually several different Open Solaris AMIs with different application software stacks pre-configured inside, which means that you can now actually, if you're an organization has a mixed base where you have some Solaris apps and some Linux apps, you can realize an exact copy of your internal application network and your multi-layer processing in the cloud. So I think this brings some pretty powerful capabilities to developers.
Yeah, that's great. That is great. Other stuff we saw, and some of this was around the Web 2.0 show, which is now a few weeks behind us, but I was intrigued by IBM's iDataFlex, which they claim is a water-cooled system. And so when you go to check it out, it's the water cooling isn't actually going through the servers. The water cooling is going through the back door of the rack, which then has to plug into some pipe similar to the way your refrigerator does. But you can almost see the future of where the entire building, from the data center to the hot water to the thermal cooling system of the whole infrastructure, will be integrated in a way that's maximizing where the heat needs to go and where the cooling needs to go. But Jim, you were talking a little bit before about how they, before we started, about how they're positioning this a little bit towards private clouds, perhaps.
Yes. Yeah, I find this to be a very interesting development with the concept of enterprises trying to take advantage of clouds. There's this notion of things being outside the firewall, which might represent risk to some enterprises. That's a significant concern for a lot of different companies. But there's a lot of benefits for frontline employees to leverage Web 2.0-ish kinds of services that might take advantage of things that are built on top of the cloud. With an internal cloud, companies can embrace, again, that kind of top-down approach to deploying infrastructure and services for their employees. I'm not quite sure what this means in relation to a lot of those Web 2.0-ish services that frontline employees are, in fact, embracing and purchasing. And I'll put Box.net forward as a great example of one of those cloud collaboration services that is really getting some good uptake. I'm not certain that internal clouds can necessarily capture the social networking benefits of some of those external clouds that are out there. The long tail might be missed. But this is really one of the first companies that's coming out with this kind of positioning. So I'm very interested to watch this and see what does happen.
I think along with that goes, I think they're really looking at taking advantage of eliminating overcapacitization, because one of the advantages as a cloud computing delivery service, both with you and Jeff probably sees with Amazon, is you have the ability to separate service from capacity. And so, you're not limiting this particular application, this particular consumer, to a finite server or set of servers. And realistically, in large organizations, that's the way things tend to be. Historically, people have purchased their own servers. And even when they've tried to have shared farms of servers for particular purposes, you end up with this massive accounting, overhead, as well as this usually a massive overcapacitization of resources. And by moving to internal clouds, you're really able to to separate the service being offered from the infrastructure on the back end. So I think that's maybe where they're poking their eyes at first.
Yeah.
A couple of other announcements. Moso, which I believe is a division of Rackspace, launched CloudFS, which is really more of a storage cloud service offering. you know, interesting to see what they'll try to do from a differentiation perspective. It seems like it's getting harder and harder to pick. So we'll see what happens there. HP also launched their Extreme Data Storage System, which I think is initially targeting some of the web scale application folks. So, you know, we still have the big system vendors saying, we're going to deliver this type of cloud infrastructure to whoever needs it, the big web company or big private company. And in my personal experience, I find that a lot of these large companies aren't necessarily going out and buying the premium branded hardware, but are in fact are doing a lot of background work to get smarter on software internally so that they can build these things at a really cost-effective manner. You know, Google's quite public about their new file system and so the big table and MapReduce and all that type of stuff. Amazon doesn't necessarily get into that much detail. Jeff, you don't necessarily talk about all the internals the way sometimes that Google does.
No, we don't. And there's a couple of reasons for that. So first, we actually believe that the way we build things internally is something that is a real competitive edge for us. And also, I'm really trying to raise up the way that developers think about the cloud itself, where there's certainly things we could talk about internally, you know, what kind of racks and servers and cooling and so forth that we do. But I really would prefer that developers think about the cloud as this resource collection, this resource allocation system, where they can simply make requests to the cloud and get what they need without worrying about model numbers and brands and so forth. They say, I need some processing, I need some storage, and the cloud says, okay, I've got exactly what you need, here it is, and let them go from there.
I think that's the right model. But, you know, it's just a natural habit of folks, I think, in technology industries to want to know what's behind it. We're all tinkerers at heart one way or another, and it's hard to turn that inquisitiveness off.
I would agree. And as a technologist myself, I always want to know what's inside. And the natural response from anybody is, you know, how much memory and how big is this and so forth. And you have to, it's a different way of thinking for people to say, I would love to know, but I actually don't really need to know. And that's the thing I've been trying to distinguish with, you know, with developers. Do you actually need to know because it affects the way the decisions you make? Or is it just your natural curiosity and respect for technology?
Yeah, it's liberating to say that we actually don't need to know.
I actually found very interesting example not so long time ago. Small online backup vendor Mozia was purchased by EMC, and when this acquisition happened, EMC was very open, and they said that we purchased because we want to learn how to build large storage cloud using commodity hardware, and that's from a company that is famous for Symmetrix and Clarion and other high-end storage.
Yeah, great. Well, the other piece of little news, that not really news, but there was a video that was online at CNET from the Web 2.0 show, What is Cloud Computing, and had about 10 industry experts there. We'll put a link to that in the show notes, but again, I think it is interesting how many people are racing to create definitions. They were giving up on the definitions front. There's something here, we're going to enjoy talking about it, and this is a perfect time to transition and get into our company focus today. We're going to talk a little bit specifically about Zamanda and some of their offerings, a little bit about Amazon Web Services and their offerings, and then a little bit about the partnership between the two companies. So let's start with you, Dimitri, on the Zamanda side. If you could give us a quick overview of intro to the company and then some detail as to the, I understand cloud computing isn't the entirety of your business, but there's some extensions and portions where that affects your customers.
Sure. So Zamanda is in business for 3 years now, and we are the leader in open source backup and recovery software. The idea is to democratize backup and recovery market, because today you have very large players such as EMC and Symantec Veritas that sell very expensive software that costs thousands and sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars, and with no real benefits to end users. So we decided to break into this market and to create business innovation. So we are offering open source backup and recovery software, and what it does, it backs up multiple computers on a network, and computers could be of any operating system. It could run any type of application such as Oracle, MySQL, or Microsoft Exchange, and we can back it up to different types of media, such as tape or a disk. And because we have very strong community behind our project, it was almost 18 months ago, one of our community members, he raised this question. So in addition to using disk and tape, did you guys think about using Amazon S3? And we found that it was really interesting idea, and we jumped on it. And as a result of collaboration with Amazon, in January of this year, we introduced backup to Amazon Storage Cloud, and it was very successful offering. We have a lot of new customers, and again, the power of this offering is that it doesn't break backup policies and backup procedures that people had before. In addition to what they had before, now they can also provide backup and recovery to Amazon, and it, that gives them very, very robust disaster recovery capabilities at very low cost.
So in a sense, it's just like choosing another backup device, in that, you know, I can back up to a virtual tape library full of disks, I can back up to a traditional tape library, and I can also back up to Amazon S3. Is that the way
exactly
to think about it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've been surprised was actually the amount of uptake we had from customers, because the, you know, like anyone who comes from an infrastructure background, particularly an enterprise infrastructure background, as we were talking about earlier, I'm a natural skeptic towards things going outside of the firewall. But Dimitri brought up a good point once, said, well, what's the difference between it going into the cloud and you shipping off a bunch of tapes in a truck somewhere? And that's when the light bulb came on for me. And surprisingly, with very little outbound evangelism on our part, people have instantaneously got that, and we've actually gotten a lot of very unique inquiries from potential customers who want to do this exact thing. So I think it's really, again, the fact that we're allowing them consume cloud services, which is very cost effective and actually has several advantages over physical media in this case, without having to necessarily worry about how do I integrate that into my business and technical processes.
Yeah, I've got a quick question. Do you provide any web-based service or some sort of application layer that allows your customers to then access the data that's stored at S3?
Right, and this is part of that's part of our core software. So
it is. Okay. Gotcha.
It is, right. So it is very transparent to the end user when they decide what to backup. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions we ask, where do you want it to backup to? So, and one of the options is Amazon S3.
Right.
So, and after that, they don't even know where it is. So, but right, when they need particular file, they can find it and they can recover it back to the same machine or any other machine on that network.
Do you have different costs for the different modes of backup, or is it just one price and you kind of get to choose? Your customer would get to choose where the data gets stored.
It is one cost. It is one cost because, again, we believe that our pricing is, simplicity of our pricing is our competitive advantage, mm-hmm. and we are trying to make it as easy and as simple to people as possible. And what's also very interesting that Amazon gave us an opportunity to create such a product that gives two different relationships for end customers. On one hand, these customers have a relationship with Zemanda. Mm-hmm. They buy software from us, from us, subscription to software from us. And on the other hand, they have financial relationship with Amazon, and this is very important because, first of all, people trust Amazon, and second of all, Amazon provides them with service level agreements, and service level agreements that we, on from our end, would never be able to provide, and
sure,
it makes it very, very interesting to our users.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you one question, Dimitri, and then I'll let Jim jump in. Are there any patterns that you've seen with the type of Zemanda customers who are choosing the S3 service, or any trends or things you've seen in the customer base as to why this has been taking off, which type of folks?
It is really, really surprising personally for me, because backup administrators tend to be the most conservative people in IT. And these people, they see value and they jump on this new technology. So that was actually very unexpected result. And to answer your question, we see all kind of customers. We have a lot of Web.2 companies. We have companies that build their whole infrastructure on Amazon Web Services, companies such as SmugMug, for example, they're our customers. And at the same time, we see lots of government research institutions, and I will let Ken to jump in because he deals much more with end users. Yeah.
Thank you, Dmitry. Surprisingly, companies which are under a lot of regulatory requirements have been investigating this option. I thought that that would be a huge deterrent just because of the burden that's on Amazon to provide things that are, whether it's compliance with regulations like Sarbanes-Oxley or HIPAA or state medical regulations. And so far, that hasn't been a barrier. So, I mean, I guess that's more of a kudos to Jeff and the Amazon Web Services team for building something that can and being able to have those things in mind to actually enable us to deliver something that doesn't have those business barriers.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask about the SLA. Like, any insight in your sales process, is it that Amazon SLA that really does make a difference in comfort level for the conservative purchaser?
I believe it is. For a certain type of customer, let's say some government institutions, so it is very, very, very important that the fact that they have SLAs and sure. That there are some financial penalties. If
I think it's also interesting that the whole trend event originally that drove backups to tape was the cost of media storage, mm-hmm. and the fact that tapes were a portable kind of media. And what's interesting, but as soon as you start to integrate offsite storage into that equation of cost, you're now having to store these tapes over time, move them,
right.
And
keep
your fingers crossed. Exactly. And you have to manage them. You have to index and catalog and know what you have.
Right.
And what's interesting is, you know, that which keeps out of play the smallest companies, and then you kind of grow into the medium companies, and they start to come into where this is not a prohibitive cost and go that. But as soon as they become a larger company, then you're talking it's a prohibitive cost again because the management costs outweigh the benefit. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting is because the costs of moving data to Amazon S3 and storing on S3 scale linearly with the size of your business, it's approachable to everybody, and all of a sudden this extra layer of protection is now available to all businesses, and every business values their data.
The trickle down effect of the benefit of lower overhead from Amazon through
exactly.
You to your end customer.
Exactly.
One more question that I would have for the both of you guys relates to the channel. I saw on your website you do seem to have a fairly mature set of relationships with a host of different channel partners. Any insight from your channel and you know the folks that they sell to on embracing the S3 component?
I cannot see any patterns yet. So I would say right now we actually see requests for the manned internet backup mostly from end users, not through channels. So I guess you see more of those Wall Street Journal articles before it gets propagated to through the channel.
The only thing I would say is in the context I've had with those partners, they're asked, you know, hey, what are you doing with this cloud service or that cloud mm-hmm. service? So mm-hmm. they all have their own initiatives.
Right.
And I think it's kind of a sign of how mature and progressive an organization you are is whether or not you're able to keep, you know, how well you're able to keep close to the bleeding edge of technology. As you
Right.
Great. Well, let's shift over and spend a little bit of time with Jeff since we have him here. Jeff, maybe you can just start out with your, 1 to 2 minute overview of the fine work that's going on over there, and we'll dig into some more details after that.
Okay, sounds great. So it was actually really awesome to hear about Dmitry and Zamanda and how you're using S3, by the way. For the last several years, we have been in this this quest to open up various parts of Amazon's core infrastructure to outside developers. And, you know, basically things like S3, our storage system, and SimpleDB for scalable database, EC2, the Elastic Compute Cloud, which is servers on demand by the hour. We've been opening all these up. We've been putting web service APIs for both SOAP and REST style calls into the cloud. We put on top of that, we of course put security, and we put metering so we can track usage. We put billing models, and so we allow developers to sign up for these services. They create a developer account for free. They attach their credit card. We give them a key that they pass into the calls that they make to us, and then we track their usage on a very fine-grained basis. So we have what is called a pay-as-you-go model. So much like you would pay for your cell phone or your electricity or your water, it's a utility billing model where exactly how much you use, the number of gigabytes or the amount of that you store or the amount of bandwidth that you transfer or the number of server hours that you use. Developers pay us exactly what they have consumed. They don't have to sign up to any minimums. They don't sign up for long-term plans of any sort. It's totally flexible, both on the upside, as they might scale their usage to just gigabytes or terabytes or petabytes even, or to hundreds or thousands of servers. They simply consume what they need and pay accordingly. So it offers them a lot of flexibility, offers them the ability to not have to worry about a lot of the lower level details of creating and dealing with infrastructure.
Right. Now there's I was able to pick up some of the data sheets when I was at the Web 2.0 Expo a few weeks ago. And there's a list of Amazon Web Services here that's about a dozen long. And I was curious if you could just share with us, you know, what are the highlight services where you've seen the most adoption? What do you think perhaps are the services that are likely to change the whole cloud computing model the most over the next couple of years, but maybe haven't received the most airplay from a general public discussion perspective? Any thoughts on those two questions?
So you want me to choose my favorite child, basically. So. I think that the funny thing I'm seeing, and I hear this from developers, and I talk to a ton of developers when I go out on the road, is that they really like each of the services individually, and each different service has its own appeal to a particular audience of developers. But what they're really finding value is that as we roll out new services, each service seems to actually, in a sense, make the other ones more valuable because they work together, and also because of the fact that each of these services are all running in the same Amazon data centers, we can give them a real cost break on the bandwidth between the services. So, for example, a very common use case that we'll see is we'll see developers storing huge amounts of data in Amazon SimpleDB or in S3, and then they can move it over into EC2 for processing. They can do analytics. They can do number crunching on it. They can store the results back into SimpleDB or S3 afterward. And we don't actually need to charge them for that bandwidth going back and forth. So there's this really neat economy of scale we can do because we have multiple services running in the cloud. So can I pick a favorite one? Probably not. As far as things that the world is still working to figure out, I would say that SimpleDB is definitely on the leading edge. People are still getting comfortable with the idea of a post-relational database model, of not having to pre-declare your schema, and of having something a lot more dynamic and a lot more flexible that simply adapts to the way you use it, rather than having to do the old model of designing your schema, designing your indices, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I'm expecting pretty big things from SimpleDB.
Great. And then another one that you had mentioned to me, which very close to my background, is the persistent storage blocks, which I think is relatively new, just maybe a month or so old.
Right. That's actually so new that we don't even have a final name for it yet. It's in very early alpha testing with a small group of users. And basically what this does is the current model with the compute cloud is that when you allocate servers, the disk space attached to those servers has the same lifetime as the server. So if you get a server for 3 hours and you store things to its local disk, at the point when you release that server, the local disk is, of course, reclaimed and then used for another user. After it's been scrubbed, of course. Now, with the persistent block storage, you have this idea that the storage itself is now a separate allocatable, mappable entity in the cloud. So you make a request to the cloud, and you can make a single request to the cloud, and you can say, give me a terabyte of storage. we give you that amount of storage. It's high performance, high availability storage, and you can use it just like it was a Unix file system. So you can make a file system on top of it. You can mount it onto a compute cloud instance. You can store as much data as you'd like. We give you a snapshot facility to basically make a snapshot backup into Amazon S3. And so forth. So I think that the persistent block store was one of those pieces that everybody thought should have been there from the very, very beginning. But of course, the engineering to design that and to build it has been a fairly big job for us.
Okay, so just to make sure I understand this correctly, then if I were to have this persistent storage block, I would access that via an EC2 instance.
That's correct. So what you do is there's several different steps. So first you make a cloud request and you tell it how big of a block you'd like, and you can do it anywhere from 1 gigabyte up to 1 terabyte. You then make a second cloud request that says attach this block to this particular EC2 instance, where it then shows up as in Linux terminology as a raw device. Once you have that raw device, you then use the standard file system creation command mkfs to put a file system on top of it. And you mount it onto the system, and it looks just like it was local disk, except it's going to persist for longer than the lifetime of the EC2 instance.
Right. And then if you're just after direct access to storage, then somebody would go with the S3 model. If they were direct access from outside the Amazon data center, I should clarify.
That's right. So S3 is a different model where people store individual objects in S3, and the objects can range up to 5 gigabytes at a time. They're always reading and writing entire objects versus block storage, where you pre-allocate a space and then you can then do essentially byte level reads and writes inside of there.
Right. Are there any example applications or use cases that have been part of the alpha activity around this service?
There's a lot of things happening, and none of which I'm actually allowed to talk about just yet. I'm expecting lots and lots of cool things to emerge from this.
Great, great. Okay.
It allows us to loop back to the initial article that we were talking about from Andy Kessler about platform as a service. What it sounds like what we're talking about here is some persistence in the availability of blocks of data, and with the EC2 component on top, right, that's where you can really start to build services and applications on top of data. And this can really allow companies to change the way that they put business models out into the marketplace. I find this to be quite fascinating stuff. So, Jeff, could you talk to me a little bit about the self-service component of your sales model? Like, talk to me about the degree to which your sales team is involved with customers, or is this entirely... everything's documented and available on the web, and they just sign up and do this?
Okay, so a whole range of things that we do. So at the very straightforward level, what will often happen is that I'll be out speaking, or one of my other evangelists will be out speaking. Well, let's say we're at some kind of a conference or a user group. We talk to developers and entrepreneurs about these services, and they say, hey, this sounds kind of cool. I'd like to sign up. So they go to aws.amazon.com. They create their developer account. They then choose the individual services that they would like to sign up for. They agree to those licenses. They put their credit card number in. And then there's just a little point on the developer portal, which gives them full access to their private and public keys that they use to make their web service requests. We have a huge amount of documentation. We have sample code. We have tools and libraries for various different languages and development environments. And they can just take off and get going right there. So that covers the let's get started all on my own model. For the larger customers, for the governments and the corporates and the research institutions and schools and so forth, we have a business development team that, they do a lot of work to go out and actually find customers, and they also work with customers that might have heard about us through a conference. And they're generally the larger organizations, the ones that are a bit more traditional. They'd like a little bit more. Maybe they have lots of questions. They need a bit of hand-holding to go through the whole sign-up process and make sure that they understand the implications of the license and so forth.
It's very interesting what you describe with sort of larger companies needing more hand-holding and maybe a different type of selling is exactly what I see at Box.net with our enterprise service. I've got several different types of selling going on, from web trials that convert to paid accounts to sort of inside sales where warm leads come in and, some light hand-holding, but they're basically ready to go. to the, you know, let's go out and find them and get them into this cloud collaboration service. Very interesting.
It does seem like it's hard to get anybody going in cloud computing without a little bit of this self-service model.
Yep.
Well, one thing I love about the self-service model is, and I've seen this happen a couple times at the various conferences I've been at, is I'll be up there on the podium describing these services, and I'll be at, let's say, a very technical conference, and developers have actually signed up while they're sitting there listening to me talk with their laptop. And one very memorable conference, I remember by the end of my session, Tim Bray, who's at Sun, he raised his hand and said, "Jeff's not BSing us at all. This stuff really works. I actually built an app while I was just sitting here listening." And that turnaround from idea to application in 45 minutes, I love that, where they get that initial success and then they can just build on it from there.
Sending Jeff to conferences as a sales strategy. Very interesting.
Absolutely. That's part of what I do.
Dimitri, you had a comment?
Yes, I want to add that Amazon makes it really easy for us, and we are, in a way, end user for Amazon services, to share revenue. So we use the service that is called DevPay, and it makes it very, very easy for us to establish this relationship I was talking about earlier, financial relationship between our end users and Amazon. And once per month, Amazon just sends us check, and of course, it's beautiful and it works very well.
So when you were talking earlier, Dimitri, just to spend a couple minutes on the integration and the activity between the two companies, did I hear you correctly that a user had asked about backing up to S3 and that sort of spurred the...
It was our community member. So we have two offerings, similar to Red Hat and MySQL. We have a community edition and enterprise edition. And of course, there are many more installations in community. And one of community users at this point, he was, I think, a student or system administrator at University of Chicago. And now he's our employee. But he had this really cool idea and he actually implemented it. And that's how it started.
Oh, so it was actually some of the initial development work took place at that end, and then you guys were able to incorporate that and offer it more formally to the broader...
Take it to the next level, take it to the next level, and to establish a formal relationship with Amazon.
That's great. That's great. Jeff, you know, any perspective from your side on the partnership with Zamanda and how these kind of things work in general with Amazon Web Services?
Well, it sounds like this is kind of a by-the-book model. This is exactly what we love to have happen. And it's great to hear that Dimitri and Zamanda have the same focus on customers that we do. Because one of the benefits I always see from going out and talking to developers is sometimes I just shut up and I'd like to listen. And I'll actually just sit there with pen and pencil and I'll say, tell me what you like and what you don't like and give me some ideas and suggestions and complaints. And having that feedback loop where you can actually go from being out in the field and hearing that voice of the customer, bringing that back into the company, having the maturity as a company to respect what your customers are asking for and saying, these folks really understand the problem really well and we should pay attention to them. And to bring that back into the organization and say, this is what customers want, let's actually do it, is really, really important. It's super important. A lot of companies would like to claim that they are, quote, customer-driven, but this is an example of that in action, and I love to hear those kinds of stories that you hear a great idea, you investigate, you do it, and you can sometimes even go back to that individual customer and say, you asked us for this, and this is what we did for you. And closing that feedback loop is, I can't say enough about how valuable that is to just show how much you listen to and you respect your customers.
Yeah, I think that really is a great story. Well, at this point, I think we should wrap things up. I want to thank everyone on the phone and just give folks an opportunity to point people in their direction. So we'll just spend a second going around. Jeff, if you want to start.
Okay, two sites I'd recommend would be aws.amazon.com, which is the core of our web services offering. And then we also have the AWS blog where we talk about new offerings and happenings in the community. That's aws.typepad.com.
Great. Dimitri?
And for us, please visit our site, zamanda.com, ZMANDA.com. And we have Wiki, we have forums, we have blog, and many other ways how you can, many demos. That's how you can see what we do.
Great. And I'd just like to thank Ken and Jim for joining us. Anywhere in particular to follow you guys individually or at the company information?
I post on our Zamanda blogs occasionally, so you'll see me up there. And I'd just like to add to Dimitri's comment that we do have a freely available community version of the Amanda technology. So you can download, check it out, and if it's something you like, and then you want to take advantage of S3, go ahead and give us a call, and we'll be happy to help you.
Great, and thanks for co-hosting today, Jim. Really
sure.
Appreciate it.
Sure. We also offer free service for cloud collaboration, storage as a service, and box.net's where you'll find me.
Great. Well, that's it for today. Really appreciate everyone listening and joining us for the Cloud Computing Roundtable. We're currently hosting this on the Gear 6 company blog, which is at thoughtput.com. So if you need more information or want to check some of the details of things we mentioned in the show, please feel free to check that out at thoughtput.com. And again, for the Cloud Computing Roundtable, I'm Gary Orenstein. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.